Cherokee, Gabriel was edgy. If the Contras appeared, protocol demanded that Gabriel, the subordinate, shoot it out, while Mame escaped. They both had 38 supers strapped, eyes popped. Gabriel monitored radio frequencies to make sure the road ahead was clear and answered calls on several cell phones plugged into the console. In the back of the Cherokee, a long-arm assault rifle, una larga, was attached to a tripod bolted to the floor. In his head, he rehearsed the steps to unlock the clavo, the hidden compartment behind the dashboard, where more guns were stashed. 1. AC to high. 2. Gear in neutral. 3. Lock door. 4. Pump brakes. The Bruno Orozco debacle and 3 months in county had taught him that operating on the American side was more difficult than Mexico. He wanted to keep working for Mame, bringing him cars and weapons and maybe transporting small drug loads, but he decided he wanted out of the company. He didn't want to do more jobs in Texas. He didn't want to go back to jail. During the four-hour ride to Nuevo Laredo, he tried to feel Mame out about the future. "You could have been assigned to a hotter plaza like Monterrey or a city in Michoacán," Mame explained. "In those places you'd get in gun battles with the Contras and the Federales every day." Gabriel knew Mame was right. Since getting out of jail, Gabriel and friends from La Azteca had kept in touch with Wences. Wences would call to say what's up from some place like Michoacán, the southern state, and tell them about missions down there. The next day, they'd see it in the paper and say, "Damn, that squirrel is flying high." "You're assigned to the border," Mame said, "because you're the most trusted sicario for difficult jobs. The company has plans for you. You've been singled out." "Singled out?" Gabriel asked. "Absorb everything," Mame said. "Be ready. It won't be long until you're sent to the six-month camp and you become a commander." Mame had been instrumental in Gabriel's development, taking him to Reynosa and Matamoros, teaching him how to operate. Mame vouched for him and oversaw his progress, and Mame was generous. Once, they'd been in a club when Gabriel complimented Mame's style. "That's a cool shirt, Way." And right there, as strippers swirled on poles, Mame took off his Versace shirt and traded it for Gabriel's old raggedy guest shirt. Mame loved him. Plus, Mame was Catorce's favorite, his consentido, an advisor, and Catorce was the co-chief of the Zetas. "The most trusted for difficult jobs? A commander? Who's my man? I'm the true one." If Gabriel ever questioned the organization's loyalty, Mame's words changed his perspective. He felt something for Mame. It was stupid to think of him as a father. But Mame had saved Gabriel's life, showed him how to do business, and imparted confidence. So when Mame said being assigned to the border meant Gabriel was privileged, well, it made sense. He had met Mame while smuggling cars and weapons. Of self-made capos, underworld lore often had it that they started out in precisely such jobs, in precisely the way Gabriel started. "I remember when LCL would get us cars. I remember when Miguel ran Malta to Dallas for so-and-so." You got what you set your mind to attain. Maybe the Chuckies weren't that bad, Gabriel thought. Wannabes, sure. But also brothers who could stand up and do jobs instead of you. He thought of his murder case. By the time his trial came around, he'd most likely be in Mexico full-time, where he was untouchable. As he and Mame neared Nuevo Laredo, Gabriel asked what running a plaza entailed. Mame thought about it, a good question, and responded with several generalities. "Always be disciplined. Respect everybody. Compliment your sicarios. Don't degrade them." Gabriel nodded. Surely there was more to running a plaza, but there would be time to learn. They reincorporated in Nuevo Laredo, where everyone was watching the video. Like any transformational event, a story about the video developed internally and filtered down through company ranks. 5 Zeta sicarios had gone to Acapulco with instructions to kill cops on the payroll of La Barbie and capture the plaza. They knew the rules. Don't go clubbing, don't go out at night, and never go out alone. Whether it was insubordination or a youngster's inability to resist the seaside resort's nightlife, the traveling assassins went to a club where their Norteño looks marked them as outsiders in Acapulco's insular narco community. It was 15 minutes before cops tipped off LaBarbie. Los Zetas were in town to kill him. The next day, LaBarbie's men raided their safe house and rounded up three of the assassins. While escaping, the fourth assassin dropped his cell phone in the backyard. The fifth was in town, using a payphone to call his sister, when LaBarbie's guys punched him in the stomach and hustled him into an SUV along with his wife and two-year-old stepdaughter, brought along to enjoy vacation. The escaped sicario drove through the night. When he delivered the news in Nuevo Laredo, Miguel Trevino called the lost cell phone, asked for LaBarbie, and requested the return of his men. "I'll pay you whatever you want." "Nah," LaBarbie said. "I have money." "Okay, the plazas. Reynosa and Nuevo Laredo. Las que más quieres, las que por más peleas. The ones you want most, the ones you fight for." LaBarbie wasn't dumb enough to fall for that one. "La guerra es guerra," he said. "Then let the family go." LaBarbie kept the wife and stepdaughter overnight. The next morning, he made the girl a bowl of cereal with a banana and let her play in the pool. "Your husband said to tell you that he loves you," he told the new widow, and gave her 1,000 pesos, about $70, to get home. In the DVD video that had now surfaced months later, four men, three of them shirtless, sat on the floor, bruised and bleeding, against a backdrop of black garbage bags taped to the wall. LaBarbie, standing behind the camera, asked the captives to identify themselves and describe their jobs. "I was in the army for 8 years," said the first. "I have the contacts in the military to find out about the patrols." He explained that the Zetas were upset with the Attorney General of Tamaulipas because he was taking bribes, yet consenting to military operations against the company. He also said Nuevo Laredo's newly elected police chief would be killed for raising too much attention, referring to the police chief who was assassinated the prior June, hours after taking the oath. LaBarbie moved on. "I was in Gafe," said the second. "Now I'm a recruiter." The Zetas recruited people even if they weren't Gafe deserters, he said, and trained them in one of four camps, Nuevo Laredo, Monterrey, Miguel Alemán, or Ciudad Mier. "I used to work as a hawk," said the third, meaning a spotter, someone who lurked in the plaza and looked for contras. "Then they put me on the caravans, picking up people with Miguel. After capturing someone, Miguel or Mame Flores says whether or not to take the captive to the guiso." "What's the guiso?" LaBarbie asked. "It's when they grab someone, they get information about moving drugs or money, they get what they want, and then, after torturing him, they execute him. They take him to a ranch, they shoot him in the head, they throw him in a can, and they burn him with different fuels, like diesel and gasoline." LaBarbie asked about a female radio reporter in Nuevo Laredo who'd recently turned up dead. "Lupita Escamilla was responsible for writing the news and making sure things didn't come out on the national level, but then she refused to continue working for them, so they sent someone to kill her." "And you, buddy?" LaBarbie asked the fourth, a young man known as Pollo, whom Gabriel knew from childhood. But before Pollo could answer, a gun came into the camera frame and blew his head off. It was the first time Gabriel had seen a friend killed. The film cut off there, but presumably the others were shot the same way. The company put $1 million on LaBarbie's head. By most accounts, he had taken up residence in Acapulco, on Mexico's south coast, but some believed that he visited family frequently in Laredo. Out of jail for 1 week, Mame's words still ringing in his head, Gabriel, having returned to the Roches after finding religion in jail over the summer, decided he would do whatever it took to succeed in the company, kill LaBarbie, and become the next American drug lord. In September, around the time Gabriel Cardona bailed out of jail, Angel Moreno's opinion about the possibilities of opening an OSEDEF investigation of Zeta leadership changed. Moreno took a routine plea meeting with the busted American drug smuggler from Dallas. Mario Alvarado's pink stash house on Topaz Trail in North Laredo had been busted following a routine Crime Stoppers call. Alvarado had 80 pounds of weed stuffed in a couch and a few kilos of coke hidden in a TV. Personal use quantities for a guy like Alvarado, but enough weight to warrant serious prison time. Looking to cut a deal and reduce his sentence, the 22-year-old Alvarado entertained Angel Moreno with an epic story of dealing directly with Zeta leadership for the past 4 years. Alvarado said he knew the Trevino brothers, Miguel and Omar, and their Zeta network personally. Alvarado said he hunted with them, did business with them, was even held hostage by them. Moreno thought back to his summer lunch meeting with Robert Garcia and began to wonder, could he use that Gabriel Cardona kid and Mario Alvarado, unconnected but for their common link to the Zetas, as the basis for an OSEDEF investigation? In theory, yes. But to get an OSEDEF case approved, he needed at least one other federal agency to sign on. There were many possibilities. FBI, ATF, DEA, ICE. Every agency had a strong presence in Laredo, and Moreno knew all the bosses. He made the rounds, trying to build support. The goal of an OSEDEF investigation was to get big cartel bosses. But what did it mean for a drug lord to be big? The factors that form the government's perception of bigness were the same factors that form the public's perception. Media coverage. The Trevinos were not well known in the States, nor was Zeta leadership, composed as it was of obscure former special force troops like Heriberto Lascano and Efrain Catorce Teodoro Torres. La Barbie, on the other hand, had been beefing up his PR campaign. He published newspaper editorials in Mexico claiming to be a legitimate businessman and imploring the Mexican government to eliminate the Zetas, whom he called delinquents. Over the summer, Robert and Laredo PD had decided against publicizing the Barbie execution video, as it was now known. But they did share it with some people from federal agencies, such as FBI, the agency in charge of investigating missing persons, to make sure there was no confusion about the growing threat. An FBI agent leaked the video, which somehow wound up at a small newspaper in Tacoma, Washington, in the hands of reporters who didn't know much about Mexican drug cartels and couldn't translate the Spanish. The Washington State reporters ran an internet search for Zetas, which turned up news stories by Alfredo Corchado, the Mexican-American journalist who ran the Mexico City Bureau for the Dallas Morning News. They mailed the video to Corchado, who investigated the claims made in the video, wrote a story for the Dallas Morning News, and posted the video footage online. The Barbie execution video went viral, shown on a loop all over Mexican and American TV, and gave La Barbie a global reputation, erasing any doubts about what kind of business he was really involved in. From his Laredo upbringing and earlier trafficking cases, American authorities knew La Barbie. Miguel Trevino's reputation was growing within Laredo law enforcement as informants cycled through interview rooms and told stories about him, but many still believed he was a minor player. In reality, La Barbie was a successful smuggler and capable soldier, but a middling player overall in Mexico's narco hierarchy, no more or less important than Miguel. Yet the gruesome video, the articles, the Laredo pedigree, and the blonde preppy appearance all helped make La Barbie the new symbol of the war, in the eyes of the public and therefore in the eyes of American government. Washington, D.C. wanted La Barbie. The DEA had a source inside La Barbie's circle. In fact, it turned out to be the same guy who gave Robert the video in the first place. And so the agency heads declined Angel Moreno's OSEDEF plan for the Zetas. Moreno had more power than the local agency bosses, but they had jurisdiction over their own offices. They respected Moreno, but some carried bitter memories of him undercutting their influence in the past, ordering around their agents, or going directly to their regional bosses in Houston. La Barbie, they said confidently, was the target. After receiving the DVD of the Barbie execution video and watching it several times, Alfredo Corchado, the Mexico City bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News, traveled to Tamaulipas State to meet with José Luis Santiago Vasconcelos, a prosecutor who served as drug czar to President Vicente Fox. Vasconcelos, alleged in the video to be taking money from the company, wasn't eager to be interviewed by Corchado and canceled three times. Corchado finally scored the interview, but only after asking President Fox's administration to force Vasconcelos to meet with him. Vicente Fox, a former broccoli farmer and Coca-Cola executive, became president of Mexico in 2000. Despite promises of change, he'd taken what many considered a lax approach to pursuing drug lords. American law enforcement sent tips to the Fox administration regarding key criminals in Mexico. But the tips went nowhere, or were shared with the criminals themselves. Corchado had interviewed Fox many times, and believed that Fox was simply unwilling to acknowledge the growing cartel menace. Fox didn't like how foreign coverage of cartels eclipsed the image of Mexico that he wanted to establish, that of a rising democracy. "Total lies," said Vasconcelos when Corchado finally got in and forced him to watch the DVD, in which a Zeta hitman accused him of receiving bribes. "They will say any lies, especially when they're being tortured. This is nothing new." He told Corchado, "This isn't a story for you. Why don't you focus on tourism stories? They're safer." 18. All in the Gang. In early October 2005, Gabriel was back in Laredo, sitting in Nidia's salon, when a short kid walked in. He wore sandals, black jeans, and a mesh muscle shirt. He sported whiskers, catinflas, and looked stoned, griefful. He'd grown an inch or two, but still just barely exceeded 5 feet.
"Nada que ver," Gabriel shouted across the narrow salon.
"Ain't much to look at."
"You haven't changed a bit," Bart said.
Prior to his own jail stint, Gabriel had been taking calls from his old friend, Bart Reta, who was serving 13 months in the Texas Youth Commission for an accumulation of charges, including marijuana possession and aggravated assault for the time he took a shotgun to 7th grade and beat it against the chest of a rival gang member. In the ghettos that Gabriel and Bart came from, violence and volatility were taken for granted. In Gabriel's mind, a boy could be reckless, even cold, and still be a good kid. Indeed, these were admirable qualities in the street. Gabriel thought of Bart as a good kid, however, because Bart was extraordinarily loyal. He took the rap for others and never backed out of a criminal enterprise. Even Gabriel could see that Bart was odd, though. Bart not only disregarded the pain of others, he was incautious toward his own welfare. He thought everything was a joke. Getting arrested for aggravated assault or drug possession, these setbacks caused him less anxiety than most people experience in rush hour traffic. Taken away in cuffs, Bart always made his trademark sad puppy dog face, then broke out laughing. He could never be himself because he wanted to fit in, was how Gabriel described his friend, and blamed it on the short man complex. Behind the recklessness and the jokester facade, Bart carried the rage of a poor boy whose family couldn't feed him, of a short boy referred to as the midget by friends, of a younger boy, now 16, who assiduously cultivated the approval of his gang elders, regardless of risk and no matter the cost. On the prison calls, during the months leading up to Bart's release from TYC in July 2005, Gabriel and Bart exchanged gossip. Who was locked up? Who was out? Gabriel said he was dating a Fresa from United High. Bart said he'd been reading mythology and poetry, and even wrote some of his own verse. He could put a lot of emotion into his poetry, he boasted, and alter his voice to sound like anybody. In TYC, inmates fought every day, he told Gabriel. Bart said he manipulated others into fighting each other. He bragged of joining a California gang called Sir 13.
"Get off that viaje," Gabriel said. "Get off that trip.
Sir 13 might be big in Califas, but it ain't shit in Texas." This condescension was typical of their relationship.
Gabriel pushed Bart's buttons, degraded him. It was understood between them that Gabriel wanted the best for Bart, wanted to help him, so long as it was clear who was boss, who was the shit in the hood.
"Oh, yeah?" Bart said. "You got something better?"
"Me and Wences have something big going," Gabriel explained. "When you get out, maybe you can get a lick on it." Now, in Nydia's salon, Gabriel told Nydia to put Bart's haircut on his tab. Bart began going back and forth between the apartment Gabriel rented and Bart's girlfriend's house. Everyone knew Bart's girlfriend had been seeing another guy while Bart was inside TYC, that she had gotten pregnant and had the other guy's child. But in the hood, it was taboo to live with a girl who already had babies, so, to avoid ridicule, Bart claimed the child was his. One afternoon, a few days after they saw each other in Nydia's, Gabriel was driving around Las Teca when he spotted Bart riding a bike. He drove Bart to the Laredo Mall, where they bought Lacoste and Versace shirts, Calvin Klein jeans, a belt, a watch, cologne, polo boots, and a cell phone. Then Gabriel took Bart to Nuevo Laredo to meet some new people. Bart was an immediate hit with leadership, and Miguel decided to keep him in Mexico. Just as Mame Flores had recruited Gabriel into the company, Gabriel too became a scouter of talent, albeit a particularly well-placed scout. He was American. And just as Bart now sought the approval of Gabriel, Gabriel wanted to please his own fathers in the company. Delivering a young soldado like Bart was a good start toward his advancement. To understand what would drive Gabriel over the next 6 months, it was important to understand the difference between operating in Mexico versus operating in America. In Mexico, control came directly from the top of company management. In Mexico, a comandante de mando, a low-level commander in charge of a small group, didn't choose his own employees, and was therefore less accountable to the top. But for a comandante de mando in the States, the promotion Gabriel now enjoyed, the trust was, in his view, magnified, because he had no direct oversight, only far-flung bosses in Mexico. Gabriel took orders from Mame or Miguel, but in Texas, he recruited for his own mando, his team. Since he chose his partners and employees, he was more responsible for their actions than he would have been running a similar group in Mexico. He liked the power and the pressure, and he loved the respect from his homies in Las Teca, particularly when Gabriel's former boss came looking for work. The prior June, when Gabriel was arrested for the Bruno Orozco hit, the DEA busted Richard Hasso's drug warehouse in San Antonio. The trouble for Richard started when the DEA arrested Richard's Cuban buyer in Miami and, unknown to Richard, turned the Cuban into an informant. The Cuban had been a trustworthy client, so when the Cuban told Richard that he'd recently been ripped off and needed more cocaine to pay the debt that he owed to Richard, Richard agreed and loaded up 227 kilos. The Cuban, wearing a DEA wire, picked it up. When the Cuban returned the following week with $6 million and an order for another 400 kilos, Richard had been out partying the night before, so he asked his brother-in-law to meet the Cuban at the warehouse. At the warehouse, Richard's brother-in-law found an arresting team of DEA agents. Richard fled to Mexico, and his name came out in the ensuing indictment. Since he was supposed to be at the warehouse when it got busted, Richard's Mexican supplier, a Sinaloa affiliate, posed questions. The loss of 627 kilos, more than $10 million in coke, fell on Richard. It didn't help when his brother-in-law became a government snitch. But the supplier forgave Richard, then gave him $200,000 to open up a new line of transport and started him off with two look shipments of 50 kilos each. Trying to cut costs, Richard hired inexperienced drivers, and both loads were seized. Richard's prior successes now meant nothing. The supplier offered Richard one last option: move to Monterrey, handle business from there, and earn back the lost money. Richard mulled it. An unknown Mexican city, constant supervision, leaving his family? It might have been smart or it might have been stupid. He could make money or he could turn up dead. He decided to return to Texas,
where he sold off some old trucking equipment and used his last $15,000 to buy a load of cut-rate weed, which he moved to San Antonio but couldn't sell. He looked for transport work with people he'd partnered with in the past. But they knew he was hot. They knew about his brother-in-law, the snitch. They liked Richard, but they all claimed no longer to be working and gave him their backs. In just a couple of tumultuous months, everything he built had vanished. He was 21. In truth, the transport business was getting tougher for everyone. The battle for Nuevo Laredo had driven up cocaine prices by 25% at the border, as more blood than ever had to be shed to move a brick through Mexico. But prices in Dallas, Atlanta, Chicago, and New York didn't adjust much for market fluctuations at the border. Runners like Richard, the middleman, took the biggest hit in a down economy. Richard had a wife and children. He needed money. He needed a fresh start. Fortunes dwindling, he decided to approach his old associate, Gabriel. He heard Gabriel and some other boys from La Azteca, like Wences, had made inroads with the company, handling enforcement work. Maybe Gabriel could bring Richard in on one of his killing crews. This kind of crossover was common in the border underworld. To survive, smugglers killed and killers smuggled. Richard walked to the safe house on Jefferson Street in La Azteca, knocked on the door, and requested a meeting with Gabriel in one of the back bedrooms. At first, Gabriel just stared at Richard, amazed he was asking for work. To Richard, it was clear that Gabriel, seeing how life had soured for his old boss, was a little, well, glad. "We don't get paid nearly as much as you're used to," Gabriel said. Richard nodded. He knew the Wolf Boys had no prospects for real financial gain. Gabriel lacked smuggling know-how. He couldn't take full advantage of his Zeta connections. But maybe Gabriel could still serve a purpose. If Gabriel could introduce Richard to people in the company, Richard could establish a direct connect to the most powerful cartel. When that happened, if it happened, Richard would have to hope that his previous relationship with Sinaloa-allied suppliers would not be a problem. Second chances were rare. But if Richard got one, his wife, who'd begun to show signs of betrayal, would believe in him again. The toys, the cars, the parties, the admiration and love, it would all rush back like a video game reset. And what would he have to do? Ride along on a few hits? Who cared? These people were going to die anyway. It was time to be about his business again. Gabriel, in considering a partnership with Richard, had his own designs. To rise in the Zetas and get his own plaza in Mexico, he needed a partner who could advance the business of the cartel, someone who knew smuggling. From Gabriel's stint helping Richard on transport jobs, he'd learned how difficult that business was. Gabriel's only reservation was Richard's family. A good sicario was uncompromised. A man with wife and children was not a great candidate for an organization whose ethos boiled down to suicide missions. And still, this sense of a future and this new respect from Richard, whom Gabriel felt had snubbed him when they were younger, when Richard was the big hustler and Gabriel an upstart, inspired Gabriel. He took Richard on. La Barbie, meanwhile, made his own moves against company leadership. In September, he requested a meeting with a prominent pantera named Laura Black Widow Milano. Black Widow dated the Zeta commander, Ivan Velasquez Caballero, known by the nickname Talivan. Talivan, who had started out as a personal cook and driver for Zeta chief Heriberto Lascano, now co-ran the Nuevo Laredo Plaza with Miguel. The Black Widow accompanied Talivan to meetings with municipal police in Nuevo Laredo, where Talivan made regular payments of $50,000. Whenever they slept, five armed men protected the perimeter. The Black Widow would often come out at night to fix them something to eat. Now, summoning Black Widow through a Zeta trader in Nuevo Laredo, La Barbie met her at his Acapulco house and offered her $1 million to set up Talivan to be killed. La Barbie tried to be persuasive.
Son unos mata niños, mata familias. Y unos secuestradores, he argued.
They're child killers, family killers, and kidnappers. La Barbie said he wished to end the war and return Nuevo Laredo to peace.
Black Widow nodded. She knew that if she said no, she'd be killed. So she said yes. Then she went home to Talavan and told him about LaBarbie's plot. Gabriel searched a website that contained pictures from Laredo clubs. His uncle Raoul insisted that LaBarbie was hiding in plain sight, spending weekends at his parents' house in Laredo. Gabriel monitored the address. A Ford Expedition was parked in the driveway with its back to the garage. It looked bulletproof. There appeared to be a driver inside. Gabriel obsessed over the house until Miguel called and said, "Get off that viaje." LaBarbie was unreachable for the moment. There was other work to be done. The day before Thanksgiving, 2005, Gabriel wounded but didn't kill a Sinaloan enemy in Laredo. The next day, Laredo police went looking for him because he pulled a gun on some citizens after a minor traffic accident in a Laredo intersection. They arrested him at the Lasteca safe house on Jefferson Street. In the morning, an old Lasteca homie who now worked for him bailed him out for $31,000. It was so easy, and Gabriel joined other wolf boys at the hillside safe house where Bart, newly returned from the training camp in Mexico, was staying. They began tracking the movements of a heavyweight smuggler in Laredo named Moises Garcia. 19. Brothers of the Black Hand. "Hey," Gabriel was saying in a chauffeured SUV, speeding north toward the safe house on Hillside. "I can't believe you shot him just like that. You went right up to the window and shot him in the head." "Yeah, I think I also shot the girl," Bart said. "I shot the guy right in the head. I don't think he survived."
The chauffeur, Richard Hasso's wife, snapped,
"I don't want to know anything."
She was 8 years older than Richard, a decade older than Gabriel and Bart. She'd picked them up at a grocery store near Tortamex because none of the others were answering their calls. The boys laughed. She was an accomplice. At the house on Hillside, Bart jumped on the couch like an excited child while they waited for the evening news to confirm the death of Moises Garcia. The boys razzed Bart.
"Your first job. You're going to have nightmares."
"Nah," Bart said. He knew some were weak in the mind and could not carry it in their conscience, but he'd sleep as peacefully as a fish. Before the ambulance transported her from the parking lot of Tortamex to the Laredo Medical Center, the new widow told Robert Garcia that she and her family hadn't finished eating when her husband received a call asking him to return home. They were pulling out of the restaurant's parking lot when a white Ford SUV blocked their white Lexus at the exit. She was in the passenger seat. Her brother-in-law sat in back, beside her 3-year-old son. A young male, she told Robert, got down from the SUV. He was a light-skinned Hispanic, cropped hair, short and stocky. She thought he was walking over to say hello to her husband until he reached inside his jacket and began firing. At the hospital, the widow, having absorbed 2 bullet fragments in her back and stomach, rated pain a 9. She was heavily sedated when Robert raced back in with suspect photos. A nurse advised him that now was not a good time. Moises Garcia's mother grieved, having days earlier sat in the church pews during her granddaughter's baptism, processing the blessing of a new baby and the loss of a son. Now, on the shoulder of Zapata Highway, she sold $5 plates of chicken and rice to raise funds for the funeral. Rene Garcia, her eldest son, just felt rage. There used to be a code among gangsters, rules. Leave family out of it was a big one. Rene and Moises, 26 and 24 respectively, grew up in South Laredo. Their hood was called Santo Niño, Saint Baby. Its criminal culture was more overt than most Laredo neighborhoods. Kids there often lived alone, running stash houses and tienditas, and fathering broods of their own. With 2 or 3 tienditas on every block, Laredo PD could set up on Saint Baby any night of the week and arrest a dozen personal use buyers as they walked to their cars with fresh dime bags of marijuana, $10 worth, and $100 8-balls of coke, 3.5 grams.
In elementary school, Rene and Moises started a local gang and graduated to the junior ranks of the Mexican mafia, known as La M, or the Black Hand, a Chicano gang that originated in California. "We are soldiers of Aztlan in the land of the Mexican," stated La M's constitution, referring to the mythical home of the Aztecs. "Our actions reflect the different forms of our struggle, economic, political, military, social, cultural. We are dedicated to any aspect of criminal interest. We will traffic in drugs, contracts for assassination, prostitution, robbery of high magnitude, and in anything else we can imagine. 10% of every member's business or personal interest went back to La M. The gang's most fanatical members treated La M like a religion. They prayed to Aztec gods, spoke the ancient language of Nahuatl, and believed they were warriors. Rene was proud of his younger brother, Moises, the star hustler who made trips to Dallas and, in the lottery-like slang of the smuggling business, hit big with pounds and keys. As the years passed, they witnessed a civil war within La M.A.'s leadership. Under the banner of discipline, the organization culled its own ranks. Splinter groups bore splinter groups. In the early 2000s, Moises did 2 years in a Nuevo Laredo prison for executing a fellow M.A. member on the orders of a leader. In prison, Moises met Mame Flores. Through Mame, Moises expanded and began doing business with the company. On December 8, 2005, when Moises was gunned down in the parking lot of a Torta Mex, his brother Rene, who was in the back seat, suspected that La M was behind it. There'd always been jealousy around Saint Baby, what with Moises coming up so fast in the business. And there was also a money problem. Moises had had successive drug deals go bad in Dallas, and his so-called carnales, his brothers in La M, refused to cover his debt to the company. Well, Rene now thought, pacing Zapata Highway while his mother bagged food and soda, his brother's fate was an organizational decision, up to the leadership of La M. But it was incumbent on the carnales to handle his bro's demise internally, rather than let another organization, outsiders, do it for you. To Rene, the assassination of his brother didn't feel like the work of La M. Not with Rene's sister-in-law, pregnant, in the front seat, and his 3-year-old nephew sitting next to him in the back. The carnales would never endanger innocent family members. When the shooting happened, Rene hadn't seen an M.A. member approach the car, only a short guy emerging from a white Ford Expedition. Before Rene realized the black item the guy was pulling out of his pocket was not a phone but a gun, it was too late. Child locks kept him trapped in the back seat. All he could do was cover his nephew and scream until the shooter stopped. Renee's sister-in-law survived and gave birth the next week to a baby girl. Rumors came to Rene, including the name of the shooter, Bart Reta. Rene wanted to get his sister-in-law a new car, but he was unable to sell his brother's bullet-riddled Lexus, associated as it now was with a notorious slaying. At the plate sale on Zapata Highway, an M.A. leader, the Black Hand himself, showed up to make a contribution for Moises' funeral. The Black Hand hugged Renee's mom, then approached Rene and asked him what he needed. "A car," Rene said. The Black Hand offered to exchange his trailblazer for the shot-up Lexus. Rene agreed and handed over the title and keys to the Lexus. But he received only the keys to the Black Hand's trailblazer in return. "How about the title?" Rene said. "My sister-in-law needs that." "Forget her," said the Black Hand. "She'll be with another carnal soon. He can worry about it." Rene nodded. "Why didn't you tell me?" he asked. "Qué?" "That his number came up," Rene said, referring to his brother's death. "It wasn't our call, carnal. He owed a lot of money to the gente." The Black Hand discouraged Rene from doing anything rash. "You won't bring your brother back." He assured Rene that he himself intended to kill Miguel Trevino, but first he wanted Rene to accompany another M.A. carnal across the river to retrieve $10,000 from the Zetas, along with some coke. The money, the Black Hand told Rene, was earmarked for a new smuggling operation. It would be stupid to cook Miguel Trevino before the Carnales capitalized on the opportunity Trevino was offering them. René, now locked in a fantasy of seeing Miguel Trevino and Bart Reta together, of gutting them clean and hanging their husks over International Bridge 1 with a narco manta that read, "Don't fuck with the family," was too dog-brained with fury to disbelieve the Black Hand's nonsense. "Okay," he said. "I'll go." 20. Lesser Lords. The band's polka beats carried through the vaulted ceiling of the old ranch house in Valle Hermoso, a town just south of the border and 50 miles inland from the Gulf Coast, where a few hundred company men gathered at property owned by Comandante Catorce to celebrate the holidays and raffle off expensive gifts. The musicians of Los Tucanes were effusive on this fine December evening. One singer, then another, took a turn at the band's biggest hits, or corridos, ballads that created a new iconography of the narco world. Los Tucanes made the ballads convincing by acting them out, infusing each performance with a fierce, hard-edged humor. With his black mustache and piercing eyes, the leader of Los Tucanes married narco chic to timeless Mexican machismo, to freedom fighters like Villa and Zapata. It was folk tradition kept alive in a world of cell phones, Italian sports cars, and huge tits spilling out of tight leather jackets. The corrido celebrated modern Mexico's surreal juxtaposition, the extreme poverty and garish wealth, the elaborate courtesy and low barbarian violence. The themes of the songs were smuggling, corruption, and betrayal. Another brave man killed, another brother avenged. A spurned mistress caps her lover's bride. Women are murderous and deceitful. Poor boys, surrounded by menacing landowners, leave school to sell drugs because they are tired of picking fruit in the hills. The print media, academics, and documentary filmmakers excoriated bands like Los Tucanes for endorsing mafiosi and pursuing opportunistic relationships with armies of terror. Cartels were known to finance the promotion of new corrido bands in order to use them, eventually, as money laundering fronts. The genre's defenders, however, claimed that the ballads were a chronicle of modern life, not an ad for it. "We are an effect of the drug traffic," the leader of Los Tucanes once told the music journalist Elijah Wald, "not a cause." There was a drug war going on. The violence and romance were what people were interested in. How were corridos any different than gangster rap in the United States or the old murder ballads of Johnny Cash and Woody Guthrie? At the party, or posada, the Wolf Boys partied alongside comandantes. There were whole roasted chickens and goats, tamales, homemade tortillas, sprawling platters of salsas and jalapeno poppers, plus all the beer and whiskey and tequila one could drink. It was like the quinceañera parties that Freisas threw in North Laredo, except that quinceañeras didn't serve piles of lavadita, wash, a coveted form of cocaine from which impurities had been removed. 60 new vehicles were being given away, complements of the company's rip-off fund, monies gained from extortion. Winners of the raffles simply appeared at a designated car dealership and claimed their prize, which had already been paid for and assigned for pickup. Houses and Hummers, bags of cash, jewelry, bales of weed and bricks of coke, watches and designer purses, they were all raffled off, and the posada raged on. You could tell guests by their clothes. Comandantes paired Hugo Boss with ranchero accessories like fat belt buckles. Sicarios without rank dressed like niños papis, Mexican preppies, in tight Lacoste shirts and faded jeans. American sicarios like Gabriel, Wences, Bart, and Richard opted for a more classic look. Versace shirts, khaki pants, burgundy or brown shoes, and a faded hairstyle. They had the look of confident, self-made young men. Their studied appearance also endowed them with that semblance common to upstarts in big organizations. Eager sacrifices to a strange and powerful god. Boys going off to fight a war for someone else. Los Tucanes played for hours. Everyone danced to the bleating notes of the bajo sexto and the hard-driving accordion breaks. The sound of the corrido grated against the sexier refinements of Anglo-pop. Crass and rurally rooted, the genre was disrespected by trend-setting intellectuals, but not by company men like Catorce and Miguel Trevino. Even though Catorce hosted the party, Miguel financed the appearance of Los Tucanes, paying mid-six-figure rates for an evening of song. To have famous musicians singing of stories like his filled Miguel with emotion, for he could still feel pride. It was perhaps all he could feel. Well, pride and perhaps fear. The more power Miguel accrued, the more he worshipped respect, the more he feared losing it, the more he lost himself in work. Miguel didn't sleep well on the days when he didn't kill. He was no panachon, no pussy, but that didn't mean there weren't things that scared him. The past year, 2005, was a great one for the company and a turning point in Miguel's life. It was the year he went from mere comandante, a soldier who oversaw enforcement, led raiding parties, and managed his own smuggling business on the side, to full-blown plaza boss, the company's controller of an important territory, in charge of all illicit traffic that came through Nuevo Laredo. Miguel's string of successes changed him. Now in his mid-30s, he shed some of his old modesty, ditching the jeans and t-shirts. On this night, he wore orange ostrich boots, a shirt of white silk, black slacks, and a black trench coat, all Valentino. From a gold chain around his neck hung a gold grenade with 40, his Zeta call sign, engraved on its pineapple shell. That necklace was standard issue for ranking company men. But the gold-plated 38 Super, with a diamond-crusted 40 on the grip, was distinct. A bulletproof Porsche Cayenne was on order from the company engineer. But like a man on the rise in any highly competitive environment, Miguel, like Ociel Cardenas before him, the old Gulf cartel leader who created the Zetas, was prone to paranoia, the justified concern that the potential for treachery surrounded him in the form of fellow company men who would have loved to take his place. If Miguel was drawn to his younger soldados, the wolf boys like Wences and Gabriel, it might have been because they were still naive enough to believe that a value system did exist, that loyalty toward one's boss was more than mere camouflage. Unlike his relationships with contemporaries, Miguel felt no jealousy coming from the boys, only reverence. Miguel rarely drank, but at the party he drank 18-year-old Buchanan's whiskey from a giant bottle and called wolf boys over to do shots. When summoned for a shot, Wences mentioned that he might head out soon to go meet some girls somewhere else. Wences had been working with men for months. He longed for independence and female companionship away from the company. "Sure," Miguel said. "But stay a while longer, then you can go." Wolf boys, observing the jealousy of older company men toward Miguel, tended to assume that it was Miguel's success that engendered resentment. Look how smart he was. Who else worked that hard? But the older soldiers saw it differently. Miguel wasn't admired. He was a micromanaging dick who loved discipline for discipline's sake. If your woman called during the operativo, you better hope MT didn't call when you were on the phone with her because you'd get tablazos, spanked with a 2x4 with holes drilled in the business end for maximum batting speed, and not be able to sit down for a week. Even on Franco vacation, he expected you to call twice a day and answer when he called. If not, tablazos. What kind of vacation was that? Miguel was generous with money, it was true, but only because he could afford to be. He made his attitude plain. He was the one who battled the incursion from the Sinaloans. He was the one who secured Nuevo Laredo. Miguel was all about Miguel. He cared nothing about the company. Just look at the scheming bastard. At his own drooling envy of the Zeta chiefs, Catorce and Lazcano. Lazcano trusted Miguel and agreed to most of Miguel's suggestions regarding company operations. A year earlier, Lazcano shattered the bones in his shooting hand and could now barely work a weapon. He traveled by helicopter and with no fewer than 7 bodyguards. Miguel would have the chiefs eaten raw when the time was right, and his betrayals would destroy the organization.
Todo va a ser de la compañía, Miguel hollered. It will all belong to the company. He wanted the company to run everything, he claimed publicly. Inwardly, he wanted to be king. It had been 500 years since Moctezuma the Younger's accession to the throne made the Aztecs the unchallenged masters of a tribute empire that controlled the Gulf Coast. The warlords of Tenochtitlan originated in the mythic northwest land of Azatlan, the place of whiteness, before migrating south and taking over the whole of Middle Earth. Like the Zetas, the Aztecs began as enforcers for an established power structure. The lord of Cuhuacan, ruler of the old empire around present-day Mexico City, enlisted the Aztecs as mercenaries, just as Ociel and the Gulf Cartel formed the Zetas to handle violence, promising the Aztecs their freedom if they captured 8,000 Xochimilca enemies. The Aztec tribesmen carried out the slaughter and delivered bags of severed ears to the throne as evidence. Later, after overtaking the lord of Cuhuacan, the Aztec savages, rulers of a new empire on the muddy isle of Tenochtitlan, sacrificed their own so that spring would come, and offered children of the poor to Tlaloc, the rain god. Aztec human sacrifice was perhaps no more extensive than comparable practices among ancient Syrians and Mesopotamians, or the barbaric Germans and Celtic Druids. If Miguel Trevino was destined for greatness in the cartel underworld, it was because he personified the extremes of these pre-moral cultures. If Miguel had an Aztec model, it was Xipe Totec, the skull-faced deity who threw bodies off pyramids and chewed on human limbs. Miguel, it was said, once removed a heart by reaching through the thorax of a beheaded corpse. Later during the party, Tony Tormenta, the brother of the imprisoned Gulf Cartel leader Ociel Cardenas, took the stage and addressed the crowd, a mix of company employees, both Zetas and Gulf Cartel members. Tony Tormenta, who despite a healthy cocaine habit remained obese, gave the kind of rah-rah speech familiar to anyone who's worked in a corporate setting, where expansion and the bottom line are paramount. Tormenta said the company was making progress, from its original territories in the Gulf states of Nuevo León, Tamaulipas, and Veracruz. The company's control now reached west, to Coahuila, and even to part of Durango, into the central states of San Luis Potosí and Zacatecas, and to the crucial southeast states of Tabasco and Chiapas, where Mexico bordered Guatemala, a major gateway for traffic in cocaine and immigrants. The company's employee expansion reflected its success, Tormenta pointed out. When his brother Ociel created the Zetas in the late 1990s, the Gulf Cartel numbered fewer than 100 people. Now, from leadership to lookouts, the company, Gulf Cartel, and Zetas combined employed about 10,000, and that number would double over the next 5 years. The company also had a strong social conscience, a love of Mexico, Tormenta said. This goodwill took the form of cash to the poor, millions sent to fundraisers, and trailers overflowing with toys on Christmas. The U.S. military had its Toys for Tots program. The company had its Dia del Niño. The company men smiled. They all knew the rewarding feeling of giving a poor person a gift. How an old man would mutter, Bendito sea el señor, as he walked away. Miguel would often approach beggars on the street and ask them why they were poor. Then take them to Soriana, the chain of Mexican grocery stores, and fill a pickup truck with food. Tormenta continued. The coming year of 2006 would bring more blood, but their cause was just. The war was born of the other side's greed. It was Chapo Guzman and the Sinaloa cartel, through La Barbie and the Beltran Levas and other smuggling clans aligned against the company, who had started the war by offering rewards, a going rate, for dead company men. The company soldiers, Tormenta said, would be deployed widely, to Reynosa and Monterrey, and even to plazas in the far-off Yucatan Peninsula. Some would be sent as far south as Santa Elena, the Colombian port city, and one or two as far north as Boston. All work, he concluded, would be rewarded, and if need be, each company man's family would be compensated in the event of his death.
The men in the audience straightened and nodded like stoics. By the time company men achieved comandante status, or something above a mere hitman, most were old enough to know how the cartel life ended. Gabriel's godfather, Mame Flores, characterized the gleeful fatalism of the company man when he inhaled coke and tequila and screamed,
"Acoger y amamar que el mundo se va a acabar."
Let's fuck and suck because the world is about to end. But in January 2006, at 19, Gabriel was still young enough to believe it would last forever, that each violent engagement was something more than an isolated project. He saw the vacations and bonuses, the gifts to the poor and the trailers of toys on Dia del Niño. Such perks conveyed the sense that some company committee set loyal wolf boys on a path, coaxed along by pay raises and the promise of management. Gabriel looked around the posada. Refugees of officialdom surrounded him. Politicians and cops, artists and models. The accountant from whom Gabriel collected his company's salary had once been a federal prosecutor. The son of Nuevo Laredo's new mayor sipped tequila a few feet away. Celebrities escorted cartel leaders through an agent. Comandantes paid $5,000 a night for the company of Latin singers and actresses. He thought of the parties he used to read about in Vibe magazine. He thought of Tupac and of Suge Knight's infamous attorney who made all problems disappear. This company life really was no different. Something had happened in the 3 months since Gabriel got out of jail. He'd followed orders, did his time, and came back out. Prison is where the company lost some recruits, but he not only continued, he expanded. He brought in Richard, who was liked, and he brought in Bart, a much-loved wolf boy. Little Bart. If you wanted him to do something, all you had to do was tell him not to do it. Gabriel was proud of Bart and felt no threat. Gabriel already had credit from the comandantes. He jumped at the front of the barrel when others held back. People listened to him. Gabriel reflected on his path to this point. As a new recruit, he'd worked hard in the training camp, then bounced around from plaza to plaza and helped out restlessly, voluntarily, until the comandante saw his dedication and started giving him more important jobs. He learned the radio codes. Nuevo Laredo was Nectar Lima. Miguel Alemán was Metro Alpha. Mexico City, El Distrito Federal, was Delta Fox. Reynosa was 9-6. Nothing New was 3-4. I'm Waiting was 3-1. Army was 8-0. Puros Gauchos were the military you had to watch out for, soldiers who hadn't been bribed. Papeles, paper, meant money. Nacional, national, was marijuana. Extranjero, foreigner, was cocaine. Puntos were safe houses, but could also mean targets for assassination. Chapulines, grasshoppers, were traitors. Devices, birds, and calves were kilos. Your stack or post was your crew. Look way, my stack is all tangled up. Gabriel knew how to be around the chiefs, how to answer questions with to-the-point responses. In public settings, especially if a comandante was out with his family, Gabriel nodded discreetly but left them to their space, unlike other sicarios who kissed ass. He also learned to recognize resentment from mid-level managers who weren't keen on a younger talent. Once, when he had to abort a mission because the Puros Gauchos interfered, a comandante disparaged him in Miguel's presence. Gabriel scoffed. The guy was dick-sucking Miguel. But Gabriel respected rank. He simply said that he knew what he had to do and would do it. A soldier could piss away his rank by avoiding missions or crapping out on the operativo. He could misbehave on Franco, dry shooting or killing without permission. And then there was the pitfall of any poor kid who came into money and reputation. Unruly family who ripped a load from the wrong person, hit on the wrong woman, or threw their notorious relation's name around too liberally. Gabriel's uncle Raul, his mother's youngest brother, fell into this last category. Much of the time Raul was in jail for crossing weed or illegal immigrants, or for violating probation when his urinalysis inevitably came back dirty. Raul was always getting in bar fights, then dropping Gabriel's name when he got picked up by the police.
If you don't cut that shit out, you're going to get in trouble, Gabriel would tell him.
Raul waved these warnings off.
But you rule Nuevo Laredo.
It was true. As a favorite soldier of Mame and Miguel, during a moment in time when the company appeared to be effectively fighting off enemies and controlling the border, Gabriel was tantamount to the law. He could run free, swagger,